I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. The contradiction between the inhumane system of slavery and the lofty ideas about freedom are at the heart of this country's founding and still resonate today with the debate over the Civil War and Confederate statues. A number of universities have acknowledged their ties to slavery and have taken steps to address and redress their past. The president of the University of Pennsylvania, Amy Gutman, said that Penn would do the same after the work of students involved in the Penn Slavery Project revealed that a number of the university's early trustees and professors had ties to the slave trade and in some cases owned enslaved people. This was after the university first saying it had no direct involvement with slavery and the slave trade. Well, today in Radio Times, what this project reveals about Philadelphia's history. And here with us in our Philadelphia studio is Kathleen Brown. She's a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. In fact, she's the David Boies Professor of History, also director of the Alice Paul Center for Research on Gender, Sexuality, and Women. And she directed the Penn Slavery Project run by undergraduates. Kathleen Brown, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. And joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. is Erica Armstrong Brown. She's a professor at Rutgers University, where she studies urban history, women's history, Philadelphia history, also the director of the program in African American history at the Library Company of Philadelphia, and was a guest on Radio Times a couple of years ago about her book, Never Caught, The Washington's Relentless Pursuit of Their Runaway Slave, Ona Judge, also a book called Fragile Freedom, African American Women and Emancipation in the Antebellum City. Erica Armstrong Brown, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good morning.
Good morning. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Many ways to join our conversation. Kathleen Brown, let me begin with you and tell us how this project got started.
So I was teaching an introductory history class with my colleague Walter Licht in the history department, and we had talked in class a little bit about some of the other efforts of universities to do research on their historical ties to slavery. And I just kind of randomly threw out the question to some students, is anybody interested in this? If you are, you know, let me know. And lo and behold, a number of the students were interested in it, and we just kind of got them together. They did some summer reading, and I kind of added it on as an independent study. It wasn't even a class, actually.
And they started digging through archives and documents, all the sort of traditional research that historians do.
Yes, although we started because we were limited. There were five of them and, you know, only one of me, and I was already doing quite a bit. We just started with a pretty simple exercise to look at the early trustees. And so we sort of focused on the trustees. And like trustees in many ways in the present day, we focus on the trustees who had the money and the connections who were going to be most likely to be in very cosmopolitan economic circles. And in those times, that actually did mean either the slave trade or the trade in commodities produced by slaves. So we started there with a sample, really, of 28 of the 126 original trustees before 1800. And lo and behold, 20 of the 28, we were really able to find out very clearly, very quickly, actually owned slaves or had ties to slavery, really clear ties.
And these were the early trustees to the university, which I guess in the very beginning was called the Academy of Philadelphia.
Very early it was the Academy of Philadelphia, and then it was the College of Philadelphia.
Let me turn to you, Erica Armstrong Dunbar. I should say your name correctly after all of that.
I was going to say, yes.
Yeah, I don't know what I was thinking. But anyway, let me catch you in on the conversation, Erica. Going back, and this is before the Revolution, so we're talking about early 18th century Philadelphia. How embedded was slavery in this city?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think, you know, the work that's being done at Penn and other institutions, it's so important. But when we think about early Philadelphia, Africans, enslaved Africans, were here prior to William Penn's arrival. They were here with the Dutch and Finns and others who were living in the area. And, you know, I think when we look at the founding of the colony of Pennsylvania, enslaved Africans were central to it, were a part of it. Slavery existed. William Penn himself had slaves. He wrote that he preferred slaves over servants because you could have them for life. Mm. So when we go back and we think about the founding of the colony, slavery is present. The numbers were small compared to the colonies that were setting up in Virginia and that had been established in Virginia and Maryland. But still, the number of enslaved Africans grew over time.
Well, I'm trying to imagine. So you have enslaved Africans. You've got white indentured laborers. You've got maybe abolitionists. Maybe we're too soon to say that. And then you've got, regular white folks living in this city. How close, Erica, were all these people in this city at that time?
Yeah, that's Philadelphia is a walking city, and it was then. So these neighborhoods of people in the 18th century and 17th century were, it was close. So that for most enslaved Africans in Philadelphia, they were living in the households of their owners. And as time progressed, it meant that many of these enslaved Africans were women who were doing the domestic work required in households in 17th and 18th century Philadelphia. And so walking down the streets of early Philadelphia, it was relatively mixed compared to some of the other small cities and locations in further New England.
Kathleen, let me go back to you and even going back to some of these trustees. Can you tell us about some of them and who they were and their connection to slavery?
Yeah. So a couple of them who really seem to have stood out as the students did the research, one of them is the provost, William Smith, who became the provost in 1755. He himself owned at least one enslaved person who might well have been the first person that anybody saw when they came to the college because he was working in Smith's house. And Smith himself also did fundraising for the college. He went on a fundraising trip to South Carolina, and he was deliberately targeting the wealthiest planter families in order to raise funds. Yes. And this was not an accident. This was not, oops, oh, well, I didn't know they were involved in slavery. This was definitely, this is where the money is. And so there was no sense that the money was ill-gotten or tainted or, beneath the lofty ideals of the college. And another trustee, James Logan, was also involved in fundraising trips. He actually went to the Caribbean, had a plan to go throughout the Caribbean, ended up just in Jamaica, but again, really targeting specifically the wealthiest planters and establishing ties with them, both to get that those funds, but also to make connections. And in later years, many of these places and these planter families sent their children to Penn, and especially to Penn Medical, which was really the biggest diploma mill that Penn, the institution, had.
Well, I do want to pick up on that, but did enslaved people build any portion of the University of Pennsylvania? Do we know that?
We're still doing work on that, and this coming year, that's one of the things we want to do. The students were very disappointed that it was not easier to find some of the stories of enslaved people themselves. They found one name, and they've tracked down some other trustees, the Tillmans, James and Edward Tillman. They found a list of enslaved people, but they're not able to actually, at the moment, put enslaved people and their work directly on site, with the exception of William Smith's enslaved person and one other enslaved person named Caesar, who belonged to a housemaster named Ebenezer Kinnersley. So we're pushing on that, but we don't have the documentation for that yet. Common sense would say that a white student at the College of Philadelphia likely saw enslaved people doing the work of supporting the university
in some capacity or another. Is part of the problem is that you only have first names?
Often. that is the problem. We actually got some help, really valuable help, from a certified genealogist, Scott Wilds, who lives here in Philadelphia, and he's been coming to our meetings and helping the students try to figure out, when they get that little tiny shard of evidence, what they can do, both going forward and backward, to try to establish family connections. But it is hard work.
Well, let me go to you, Erica. This is part of what you do. I mean, I'm looking at some names: Solomon, George, Rachel, Harry, Cooper, James, Ben, Sharper. What do you, as a historian trying to piece this history together, what do you do when you just have a first name? Or can you do anything?
Yeah, no, you do. You have to. If we walk away from just a first name, then they're never recognized and the story is never told. And I think, you know, we twist and contort ourselves to find as much evidence as we can. Oftentimes we have to move forward. So maybe we find the name of a child of Caesar's, and we're able to track that person. Perhaps they become free. It allows us to kind of look backwards. And I also think that even without a surname, even without documents that specifically tie Caesar, let's say, to, I don't know, building a building, laying right. the bricks, we can still fashion a narrative about what Caesar's life would have been like. And we have enough evidence from other people, from other enslaved men and women in Philadelphia, in Pennsylvania, that would help us tell that story. So I'm hoping that, you know, one of the things the universities are doing with sort of telling this history, you know, it comes from telling the history of the university. But I'm also hoping that the focus of these sort of studies can shift to really center the enslaved.
Well, and we're almost up in a break here, but I'm assuming there were, and this is back to you, Erica, I'm assuming the difference between urban and rural slavery, northern slavery, southern slavery. For instance, were there plantations in and around Philadelphia?
Yeah, so there were, we wouldn't necessarily call them plantations, but estates, farms. So definitely, when we think about the layout of the city right now, in Germantown in particular, there were the sort of summer estates where there were larger numbers of enslaved people working at these homes. And as when you moved further out into Chester County or what have you, the numbers would, of course, pick up. There was a need for more enslaved bodies to do the agricultural work required in, say, Chester. But yeah, there was a diversity of slaveholding in Philadelphia and its environs.
That is Erica Armstrong Dunbar joining us along with Kathleen Brown, and we are talking about Philadelphia's legacy of slavery. And I should add that Kathleen Brown is director of a project, a student-led project at the University of Pennsylvania called the Penn Slavery Project, finding that early trustees, early professors, members of the medical school having ties to the slave trade. Eric Armstrong Dunbar wrote a book a couple of years ago, in fact, was a guest on Radio Times, titled Never Caught, The Washington's Relentless Pursuit of Their Runaway Slave, Ona Judge. Again, you can join us 1-888-477-9499. This is Our History, folks. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and we are getting a history lesson on the show today from Kathleen Brown. She's a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania, director of the Alice Paul Center for Research on Gender, Sexuality, and Women, and she is director of a student-led project at the University of Pennsylvania called the Penn Slavery Project. Erica Armstrong Dunbar is a professor at Rutgers University. She studies urban history, women's history, Philadelphia history, also director of the program in African American history at the Library Company of Philadelphia. Lots of history today on Radio Times. And again, you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Kathleen, you want to talk a little bit more about slavery in and around Philadelphia, just to make sure that we have this larger picture of how it worked.
Yeah, so I just want to agree completely with what Erica is saying about slavery in Philadelphia and in the surrounding Pennsylvania countryside. But some of these trustees are bringing prestige and capital, and they actually are owning larger numbers of enslaved people on rural estates that we would consider plantations in Delaware and in Maryland. And then some of them actually continue to have an important role in connection with the university. And then, as it turns out, by the 19th century, there's a huge number of really important deans and trustees who come from Virginia. So there continues to be that connection and a really, I think, a kind of a foundation in the wealth and the power of a slaveholding class, even though Philadelphia by that time has enacted a gradual abolition act.
Yeah, which I do want to pick up on. But Erica, even going back before the United States became the United States and looking at the kind of, whether it's urban or even rural slavery in and around Philadelphia, was it as harsh? Were the conditions any better for the enslaved people? Do we know?
Well, I think that question, when put to the enslaved, would say no, it wasn't
right.
Better.
Of course.
I think that, you know, we can compare the kind of work that enslaved people did in a city like Philadelphia, say, to those in rural South Carolina. It's different work. I'm not comfortable saying it was worse or better or easier than. I think it was different. And so when we think about the kind of work that, say, those who are doing domestic work have to do in the 17th and 18th century, it's entirely arduous and difficult, and to collect enough water to do the laundry for an entire house was extremely difficult, making the soap out of lye and then, you know, making certain that it's hung and ironed. All of this was very sort of time-consuming mm-hmm. and difficult. So, you know, I think it's best maybe for us to think about slavery absorbing different kinds of difficulty in, say, the North versus the South, or the urban environment versus the rural area, maybe not better or worse
right.
than.
There were enslaved people who committed suicide. There were attacks on owners. There were runaways. You wrote a book about a runaway slave, which I think, Erica, tells us a lot about the impact of this system on enslaved people.
Yeah. I think that the one thing we have to remember that even, you know, these people are enslaved in places like Philadelphia, in Boston, that much of the work that these universities are doing at Penn, at Yale, at Brown, is reminding us that slavery was not just a Southern institution, that it was something that spread throughout all of the colonies, and then through most of the new nation. And that no matter where you were, whether you were in Virginia or in Philadelphia, if you were enslaved, you wanted to be free. And we see case after case of people who, if they did not escape, they were resisting the institution of slavery by sort of everyday acts or from grand sort of movements of resistance and rebellion.
Kathleen, you mentioned the medical school at the University of Pennsylvania. Tell us more about that and its connection to slavery.
Well, one of the things I learned, in fact, all the students and I learned working with Mark Lloyd of the University Archives, was that Penn was mainly medical school. In fact, into the 20th century, the biggest portion of degrees bestowed upon graduates were coming out of the medical school. And Penn's medical school was very prestigious. It really was the earliest in North America. It drew people from, you know, all over the Americas, and especially from the southern colonies and later southern states up until the Civil War. The majority of graduates of the medical school were coming from the South, and 30% of them were coming from Virginia during the antebellum period. And some of this might have had to do with a particular dean who was dean of the medical school, 1822 to 1852, which is a pretty long time. He was born in Virginia, Dean William Horner. He continued to have ties to Virginia, and especially to slaveholding Virginia. So when you actually look at the list of graduates of the medical school in the 19th century, it's a list of the most prominent planter families. And some of this research we were lucky to get help on from Alexis Newman, who's a PhD, the one graduate school student who was helping us with this, who was part of the provost's working committee doing some of that work. And she really dug into the medical records. And it is pretty shocking because a lot of these graduates then go back to the South. Some of them start their own medical schools, and many of them become famous making arguments about biologically based racial difference, right? So they're not just doctors. They're doctors in support of slavery in very specific ways, and sometimes in the quite horrible ways they treat, in air quotes, their patients, many of whom were enslaved people in the South, once they returned to the South.
The idea that, that somehow enslaved people were inferior to white people, was that sort of at the base? And then, Eric, I'll get you back in.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yes, full stop.
Full stop.
Yeah. I mean, there were various theories about where the inferiority came from. But it's really amazing. It was a knowledge production. Penn was a hub of that knowledge production in this period.
And perpetuating that.
Absolutely. And then these guys go off and become famous, sometimes doing experiments on enslaved people's bodies.
Mm. Erica, you want to speak to that?
Yeah, I think one of the things that I was, as I was listening, it reminded me of this work that historian Dinah Ramey Berry has just done, where she focused on the life, the value of enslaved bodies from the cradle to the grave.
Yeah.
And many of these medical schools in Philadelphia in particular, actually robbed the graves of enslaved people. They took their bodies and used them for dissection, and free black people as well. And so aside from sort of moving ahead with this, you know, the inferiority of black people, of confirming that supposedly, they were using their bodies to move the field of medicine ahead.
It's really shocking. Let me just reintroduce the two of you. That's Erica Armstrong Dunbar joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. She's a professor at Rutgers University. She studies urban history, women's history, Philadelphia history. Kathleen Brown with us here in our Philadelphia studios, a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania, also director of the Penn Slavery Project. This is a student-run project, and it has unearthed all sorts of important and interesting information about the University of Pennsylvania and the fact that the university's early trustees, professors, had ties to the slave trade and in some cases owned enslaved people. And again, we got folks that want to join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. Well, Chief Justice Roger B. Taney is the author of the now infamous 1857 Dred Scott decision that upheld slavery and pushed the country closer to civil war. You probably remember the remarkable Taney Dragons who practice on Taney Field and its talented pitcher, Monet Davis. There's also a Taney Street here in Philadelphia. And now there are calls for a different name because Justice Taney's ruling is considered one of the worst, most shameful of the Supreme Court decisions. We asked Councilman Kenyatta Johnson to join us. Taney Street is part of his district. Councilman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Is it time to rename Taney Street?
Yes, it is.
What does it take to do that? No, go ahead.
Well, working in partnership with my fellow colleague, Council President Darrell Clark, who also shares Taney Street through his district and the federal post office, so we would have to make a coordinated effort to make sure that it's not a name change symbolically, but it's a name change in the fact that this street will officially be renamed after who. We don't have an individual at this particular point in time, but anyone more than this shameful Roger B. Taney. And so for me, this is a very eye-opening experience just from learning African history and African-American history. As an African American, I've always known about Dred Scott, also separate but equal when it came to Brown versus the Board of Education. But I can honestly say I never sat back and looked at the actual Chief Justice who actually made the decision. And so it's an eye opening information, but most importantly, it's disgusting and appalling as well.
Are you hearing from your constituents, from members of the public? I know there's a student at Temple University who is spearheading some of this effort, but are you hearing from a lot of people on this?
Yes. I've been hearing over the past several months from some constituents who actually live on Taney Street. And so from that point forward, I saw a petition spearheading a movement for changing the name of Taney. And from there, obviously, I'm open to support of changing the name of the actual street.
You mentioned the fact that this is also part of the head of City Council, Daryl Clark's district as well. Can you two,
yes.
Can you two just make this happen, or do you have to get everyone else to sign off on it?
Well, I think it's a no-brainer in terms of other individuals signing off. Oftentimes in council, we introduce ordinances to actually symbolically change the name of streets. But to go beyond the symbolic change, name changing of a street, we would have to invoke the federal post office so we can actually really change it. Oftentimes we do ceremonial name changing of streets, but this would be an effort to change the name of the street, similar to how Columbia Avenue was changed to Cecil B. Moore, or I think it's East River Drive or West River Drive was changed to Martin Luther King Drive, and that goes beyond an official ordinance in City Council.
Are you open to hearing of a better name for Taney Street?
Oh, yes, definitely, definitely. I mean, some people suggested Monet Davis in the beginning.
I saw that.
Some people suggested Octavius Cotto, but I'm open to anyone besides this individual who has a shameful past, who is clearly a racist, who clearly believed that one race was more superior than the other. We shouldn't have that type of history honored here in the city of Philadelphia.
Well, Councilman Kenyatta Johnson, I appreciate you joining us for Radio Times today. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, and thank you for your report on this particular important topic.
No problem. And again, Philadelphia Councilman Kenyatta Johnson, Taney Street is part of his district, and there is an effort to rethink and rename that street as well. I'm looking at you, Kathleen, but Eric, I'd like you to weigh in on this as well. We now have the statue of Octavius Cato in Philadelphia. Do you see this as part of a movement?
Yes, and Erica, I'll just say something quick and then turn it over to you. I just want to point out there's a little pen connection here. Sanford, who's the plaintiff in the Dred Scott case, married a widow who's actually was the enslaver of Dred Scott.
Oh.
And that widow, her husband was a doctor who got his medical degree from Penn.
All right.
So Dred Scott's previous owner, his widow married Sanford, and it was the movement of Dred Scott across slave lines by that Penn medical graduate. And I'm sorry, I'm just blanking on his name at the moment. We've started to feel like those Penn medical people are everywhere. They're highly influential people. But as for the statue, I mean, I think we've had an undergraduate who's had a really interesting idea that I maybe can tell you about in a little bit. But Erica, I'm interested in what you think about this.
What do you think, Erica?
Yeah, I think, you know, this is the moment. This is the moment where we see statues of Confederate traitors being removed across the nation, a moment where we are rethinking as a nation, some of us, the need to rename streets and parks. And, you know, I think that there's a lot in a name. A name means a great deal, especially when you think about the past, the sort of history of people of African descent not being allowed to name themselves, not having surnames, as we talked about earlier.
Right.
So, you know, it's time for Taney, for that name to be gone, especially in a place like Philadelphia. And, you know, if they're looking for new names, you know, hey, Caesar Street might sound good.
How about Sarah Mapps Douglas Street?
That would be even better.
Or Ona Judd Street. Why
yeah,
not?
Yeah, there
that?
You go.
lots of ideas here. Let me get some callers in on the conversation. We've got, looks like Paul from Reading to join us on Radio Times. And Paul, go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay, very, very honored to be here.
Thanks.
I wanted to stretch it just a little bit, but it involves Philadelphia. When President Washington lived in Philadelphia, and it was the capital at that time, he needed some work done on his official residence, and he had a favorite slave who was an excellent carpenter from his plantation in Mount Vernon, and he would bring him in. But Pennsylvania had become a little more liberal at that time and said you can't bring a slave into Philadelphia, into Pennsylvania for more than 6 months or it automatically becomes a freed man. And what George Washington did, very, very slyly, he would keep that carpenter slave there for close to 6 months and then at night secret him out back to the plantation and then bring him back a little later and have another 6 months of his work.
You know, Paul, let me just jump in here because you are talking to Erica Armstrong Dunbar, who knows more about this story probably than anyone in this country. Can you add to...
I'm just thinking his name would be a great honor to those slaves that did the work. So, I'd love to listen to her.
Absolutely. Yeah. Erica, we have about a minute. We might not be able to get to all of this before the break, but go ahead.
Yeah, I think he just said it all. He just told us that George Washington did create a slave rotation plan, and it wasn't just that carpenter, but it was all of the nine enslaved people that lived in Philadelphia with the Washingtons. They were shuttled back and forth from Virginia or to New York or New Jersey in order to make certain that their residency in Pennsylvania would not end their status as enslaved people. So we see the extent to which the Washingtons moved around the law to make certain that they kept their slaves.
Playing fast and loose with the law here. Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation on Radio Times talking about Philadelphia's history with slavery and with enslaved people. And again, Erica Armstrong Brown, professor at Rutgers University, Erica Armstrong Dunbar, professor at Rutgers University. I somehow made you two sisters. Kathleen Brown, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. And we are talking today on Radio Times about the Penn Slavery Project, what that's revealing about Philadelphia's history and also what we need to know about slavery in this part of the country. 1-888-477-9499. Do stay with us. Much more after the short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Erica Armstrong Dunbar, Kathleen Brown about Philadelphia and its history with slavery. And again, you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email. I've got some comments here. RadioTimes@WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can send us a comment through Facebook and also Twitter as well. Let me read something, and I'll. This is to you, Kathleen Brown. This goes back to 2016, coming from the University of Pennsylvania. And this is about Penn and its connection to the slave trade. This was 2016. Quote, Penn has explored this issue several times over the past few years, found no direct university involvement with slavery or the slave trade. It's well known that our founder, Benjamin Franklin, early in his life owned slaves, but later became a leading abolitionist, ultimately serving as president of the Pennsylvania Society for Promoting the Abolition of Slavery. What has been the response from the university since then?
So we've gotten a lot of support from the history department, from Provost Wendell Pritchett, and from Amy Gutman herself as we've proceeded with this. And I want to sort of give a shout out to the students on this. They really took the research really seriously. They did the work with integrity and with maturity. They were really disciplined. They were not just trying to do a kind of gotcha moment. They were really in it for the work and for a serious grappling with the past. So the response has really been great. We felt supported. We're going to run an actual class next year. We have one of the undergraduates coming back to continue to work with us. We have the support of a postdoctoral fellow. We're feeling like the university is completely behind us on this.
Erica, let me go back to you, and this is a question I think that hangs out as we grapple with this history of ours, is what do we do about it? What do we owe these people whose first name, we only know their first name, we don't know their surname? How do we address and redress the past, or can we?
Yeah, I think, what we owe them is a new narrative. We owe them the story that includes their lives, the toil, the labor, the very difficult conditions under which they were forced to work and live. And so I think our first order is to make certain that these people are represented in our history, that they're not forgotten, even with just a first name, to basically to say their name, right? And to have that be a part of this history. And then the next part, I think, is what the universities are doing right now, which is refashioning this history, having students themselves be a part of rewriting this narrative. I mean, that's an education. And then you can look at other universities like Georgetown University, which has really kind of stepped out front, and they are offering tuition and benefits to people who are the ancestors of the enslaved, who were a part of Georgetown's history of enslavement. And so I do think that there are ways, whether it's offering tuition, whether it's being very sort of thoughtful about the names of buildings at Rutgers University. Our new dorm is named the Sojourner Truth Dorm. So there is a way to rewrite this narrative and to be very active about it.
Let me read a couple of comments here. And Kathleen, this is the first one's probably for you. Facebook message from Eric. I'm curious, did any of the research on the part of the students reveal any initial redress or corrective actions taken by the university in its early history against such a policy or faculty or administration? And I guess the question today is, what would you like Penn to do?
Well, I'll kind of pull myself a little bit out of it, because the students actually had some very specific things they wanted Penn to do. They wanted Penn to do basically what President Amy Gutman did, which was kind of issue a statement retracting this idea that Penn had nothing to do with slavery and really trying to state much more clearly and candidly what that relationship was, with full awareness that there's more work to be done and some of the details might shift over time, but we're in a much clearer place in kind of acknowledging that past. The students also want the university to consider renaming some buildings. And one of the students, Van Jessica Gladney, has suggested even a cell phone kind of app where you could walk around and be at a building and get information about the history of the person after whom the building is named and find out about whether that person had been a slave owner or what their relationship was to slavery, which I thought was, you know, really smart idea.
Yep.
And the students really also just want to see the work continue. But we've been working with a cultural programmer who's been a consultant at the Penn Museum, Ariel Brown, and the postdoc I mentioned. So we're kind of just really getting going. And I feel like the students have been filled with some really smart, good ideas. And so, you know, we're taking our lead from them in a lot of ways, but the university has also gotten on board and has some money to throw at this. So we'll see where it takes us. I can't say for sure.
Let me get some more callers in on the conversation. Let me get, looks like James from Kimberton to join us on Radio Times. James, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello. Yes, I'm calling from the abolitionist stronghold of Kimberton, Pennsylvania. Mm. I'd like to ask the guest to comment on Philadelphia's very long history of abolition. Mm. The first document, anti-slavery document, reaching back as far as 1688.
Yep.
I'd like to draw their attention to the University of Pennsylvania connection to the 2017 book by Marcus Rediker, history professor of the University of Pittsburgh, about Benjamin Lay. Mm-hmm. He was a Quaker, dwarf, abolitionist, radical, and it's an amazingly colorful story. And he was friends to University of Pennsylvania, vaunted name of Benjamin Franklin, who published this abolitionist book in 1737, and it started it's credited with starting the Quakers of Philadelphia to start pushing away from slavery. And 1758, they said, in 18 years, you can't own any more slaves. which in 18 years after 1758 ended up being 1776.
All right, James, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Erica, can you add to that?
Yeah, no, I think I'm glad he's mentioned the sort of 1688, the Quaker influence on slavery. And I do think when we look at the history of the colony and then later on this new state, that the Quaker presence had a tremendous influence on the rate at which slavery disappears. It wasn't fast. It was not overnight. Quakers held slaves, and they held slaves for some time. So these Germantown Quakers start really making noise about it. As a person who attended a Quaker school in Germantown, this sort of gives me a bit of pride. But the reality is that we don't really see the complete obliteration of Quaker slaveholding until around the era of the Revolution. However, their role in government in Pennsylvania really brings about the dismantling of slavery, so that when we get this gradual abolition act in 1780, we start to see the slow dismantling of human bondage.
Let me read something from one of the students. This is Caitlin Doolittle, and I know, Kathleen, you want to make sure that you give a shout-out to all the students who've been involved in this project. So go ahead, do that, and I'll just read a couple of sentences that she wrote.
Okay. So Caitlin and Van Jessica, I've already mentioned. Matthew Pelizinski, who was with us in the first semester of the project, Dylan Kirsch and Brooke Krantzer, and then we were joined in the spring by Carson Eckert and an alum of Penn who shared her amazing personal family history as an alum of Penn whose family had been enslaved by Penn alum.
Oh, wow.
Brianna Moore.
What Caitlin writes was, and I found this so interesting and so important to talk about, our findings suggest that the lives of the trustees were riddled with contradiction. We found trustees who both owned slaves in their early years and went on to be intensely involved in abolitionist work in the city, and trustees who, while owning slaves, wrote words that became symbols of freedom and liberty in the early years of America's formation. No one's life is ever consistent throughout. We all live with contradictions. And Eric, I thought that was just so important. I mean, we should underscore that a number of the signers of the mm-hmm. Declaration of Independence owned slaves and mm-hmm. talked about counting slaves as 3/5 of a person.
Yeah, no, I think when, especially thinking about Philadelphia, you know, the seat of supposed liberty, that when we look at someone like a Ben Franklin, who we know was a slaveholder and then turned away from that and became an abolitionist, even someone like George Washington, who lived with slaves, his inherited slaves as a young child and held on to that property until his death, he did make a decision to will or to in his will to emancipate his enslaved men and women upon the death of his wife. And, you know, it's very clear that he did not want to live without slave labor, but he did wrestle with the complexity, the moral bankruptcy behind human bondage.
What do we do about Benjamin Franklin, Kathleen Brown? I mean, there is a statue of him at the University of Pennsylvania. He did own slaves or enslaved people at some point in his life.
Yeah, I mean, I think, so one of the things I think all the students, including Caitlin, whose quote you read, really picked up on is that this was not going to be kind of like doing an archaeological probe of a person's life and then, okay, saying, this is what we found, this is what they were. That in many cases, we did find people who changed over time. But as they also discovered, and as Erica's described, people say one thing and then do another.
Yeah.
And so in the end, we really wanted to get down to what people were actually doing and what we could find in their own records. And, you know, like just for example, we did find a Penn math professor who was one of the people who was involved in crafting the 3/5 clause. It's a tangle, and it's an ugly tangle. And what I also say to my students all the time, it's history for grown-ups. This is not – history is not out there to make us feel good about ourselves. It's not a fairy tale. We are not children. We shouldn't be approaching history the way a child would approach it. It requires some candor. It requires, you know, having a backbone and also being mature in looking hard at the past.
And by not being like children, seeing people either on pedestals, the sort of good guy, bad guy approach to history.
Yeah, I mean, if you were to really push me on that, I would say I would just relegate a lot of people to the bad guy category, quite honestly. But yeah, I mean, it does require some complexity. Right. And really what I mean is maybe also stop looking for good guys, mm-hmm. if I can dare say that. And Erica, please chime in. But I actually think that has misled us. It's not that I don't think there are people out there who are admirable, but it's really hard to find white people in the 18th and 19th centuries who really stand up. I think we can lose nuance and complexity if that's all we're doing.
Well, let me pick up on that and just frame it slightly differently. And Erica, put this to you. I remember going to Monticello about 4 or 5, 6 years ago. This was after we learned about Sally Hemings, and there was really almost no reference to her existence there. I believe that has been
just changed
yeah. recently, so you can actually learn something more about her life. And it seems like that is our history. I mean, we have to figure out how to, maybe being grown-ups, as Kathleen was saying, to really understand who we are.
Yeah, I think the work you've seen at Monticello over the past year or so really sort of reminds us that it's time to rethink that narrative. It's time to present it differently. We see the same kind of work being done at Mount Vernon, where the enslaved are being recognized and are integral parts of the presentation of these plantations. And I will, you know, I'll take us back just to this comment about the way we present history, write history, and for adults. I also, you know, I think that it's, if we really want to rethink and reteach history, then it's important for people like myself, for Professor Brown, to think about writing for children. And I've actually, the book that I just wrote, Never Caught, I've adapted for middle grade readers.
Excellent.
So, you know, 8 to 12-year-olds will have a book. Teachers can't say they don't have the text anymore that recenters that story, that puts a young black woman at the center of the story of the American Revolution, of the early republic and slavery. If we give it to our children at 8, 9, and 10, then we won't be forced to reteach them things when they see us in our college classrooms.
Well, yeah. I would love to see a movie about Ona Judge. Yeah. I'm holding out
would.
For that.
It's coming.
Very good. Okay. Kathleen, we almost have no time, but an email from Andrew. Have your guests looked up University of Pennsylvania's investment in trade and industries that were dependent on slavery, molasses trade, tobacco, cotton, agriculture? Is that some of what your students have found?
One of the things we're looking at this coming year is the Washington Manufacturing Company, which was a textile concern in Philadelphia in the 19th century using southern slave-produced cotton. Huh. And we're pretty sure there are going to be connections to the university, but we don't know yet.
So this is an ongoing project.
Yes, it
is. I mean,
it
seems like you've got a lot of history, a lot of digging, you and your students to do.
Yep, we do.
Well, I'm glad you're doing it, and I'm glad you joined us on Radio Times. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. That's Kathleen Brown. She's a David Boies Professor of History, Director of the Alice Paul Center for Research on Gender, Sexuality, and Women at the University of Pennsylvania, and Director of the Penn Slavery Project, again, a student-run project looking into the University of Pennsylvania's past. Erica Armstrong-Dunbar joining us from the NPR studios in D.C. Thank you once again for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
And she's a professor at Rutgers University, director of the program in African American History at the Library Company of Philadelphia. And again, her book, Never Caught, The Washington's Relentless Pursuit of Their Runaway Slave, Ona Judge. Also a book called Fragile Freedom, African American Women and Emancipation in the Antebellum City. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and sign up for our newsletter. Bob Ball's the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.